This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. The last 5 years of Abraham Lincoln's life were the most cataclysmic in American history. A new biographical novel by John Cribb, titled Old Abe, follows the journey of the 16th president from the 1860 election through the Civil War to his assassination. Next Tuesday at 6 p.m. on Zoom and Facebook, John will be the speaker for the virtual Southbound Lecture Series by Southern Lit Alliance. I spoke with him and with Linda Levan, Executive Director of Southern Lit Alliance. John, Linda, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us, yeah.
John, tell us more about this novel and how you came to write about Lincoln.
Well, the novel, Old Abe, basically just tells the story of the last 5 years of Abraham Lincoln's life. So it begins in the spring of 1860 when he's nominated for the presidency. And then we're at his side every page, every scene as he goes through his presidency and the Civil War. So we're with him for big, huge, iconic events like the Gettysburg Address and the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation. And then we're with him for a lot of lesser known events that I think make up a life in full, like the afternoons he stands over hospital beds looking down into the faces of wounded soldiers, Union and Confederate soldiers, and the day his son Willie dies in the White House, or the night the White House stables catch fire and he tries to rush into this inferno because he realizes his boys' ponies and pet goats were in there. So, as I say, moments that make up a life in full, and this is a historical novel, and I wrote it that way mainly to try to bring him alive. And as we know, fiction can do that in ways that nonfiction can't. So I've hoped to make him a walking, talking, breathing fellow and not just that stiff image we see on the penny or the $5 bill.
And so many people have tried to bring this person to life. Thinking about novels, I'm thinking about Gore Vidal, or thinking about movies, thinking about Daniel Day-Lewis portraying Lincoln in the Spielberg film.
Yes, yes. People have done it before, and so this isn't the first novel, although there are comparatively few Lincoln novels out there. There are lots and lots of Lincoln books. This is a daunting project in a way, because about 10 years ago, somebody counted all the Lincoln books. He counted 15,000 books about Abraham Lincoln. I think he missed a few. I think there were more than that, and that was 10 years ago. I know there are more than that now. They say there are more books written about Lincoln than anybody in history except Jesus Christ, and I think that's probably right, but the overwhelming majority are nonfiction. And so, as I say, I wanted to try to make this historical fiction. And I got the idea. I'm a literature guy. I went to college at Vanderbilt, where I majored in English. So I'm a literature guy. I've always wanted to write a novel, but I didn't get the idea for this until 2006. I was back in Spartanburg, South Carolina, my hometown where I live now. And I read Carl Sandburg's magnificent six-volume biography of Lincoln, maybe the most beautifully written of all the nonfiction biographies, especially those first two volumes, The Prairie Years. And at the same time, I was rereading Irving Stone's wonderful novel about the life of Michelangelo, The Agony and the Ecstasy, which I'm sure some of your listeners have read. I'd read it in high school, but I reread it. And it basically is just a novelized telling of Michelangelo's life. And that set me to thinking, could I do the same thing for Lincoln? And that was the original idea for the book. I ended up zeroing in on the last 5 years of his life, but that was the original idea.
Lincoln and this novel have connections to Chattanooga.
They do. They have roots in Chattanooga and Lookout Mountain. My mom is from Lookout Mountain. She grew up on the mountain. And my grandparents, Molly and Josh Warner, lived on the mountain a long time. So we coming over to Chattanooga and Lookout Mountain. So I grew up walking over these battlefields like Point Park and Chickamauga and Missionary Ridge. And that's where I largely developed my love of history in this period of American history. And of course, we grew up with stories about ancestors that fought in the war. And my favorite is my great-great-grandfather, Joseph Henry Warner, was captured at the Battle of Missionary Ridge and sent up to prisoner of war camp in Rock Island, Illinois, Lincoln country. And while he was up there, he made good friends with one of the Union soldiers who was guarding him. And they promised each other if they made it through the war, they would name their sons after each other after the war. So after the war, Joseph Warner comes back to Chattanooga. He becomes a very successful businessman, starts with hardware and then goes into coal and banking and streetcars, builds a beautiful house that's still standing on Vine Street. That Union soldier's last name was Porter. So he named his son Porter Warner. And there have been a few Porter Warners on that side of the family. And hopefully there's some Warner Porters running around, you know, Illinois, the Midwest, wherever that soldier was from, because it's such a great story of reaching across the divide in a very divided times. But anyway, I tell you this because I really, Chattanooga and Lookout Mountain is, you know, climbing around Point Park is where I think I really got so interested in the Civil War. And this book, Old Abe, would not exist without that.
What's something that you learned about Lincoln while writing this novel?
I learned so much, but I tell people that one thing I learned about him that surprised me was what a man of deep faith he was while he was president. And that faith deepened as the war went on. And of course, it was such a horrible, awful, bloody time. I guess that's not too surprising, but he may have known the Bible better than any president we've ever had. He quoted it all the time. He didn't have a whole lot of spare time in the White House, but what spare time he did, he spent reading the Bible, searching for answers to questions like, why is this war to happen? Why did God allow slavery? What does he want from us? That's the question that Lincoln asks all the time. What does God want? And he comes to the view that the Civil War was God's way of judging and punishing both North and South for the sin of slavery, because like both sides, Lincoln felt, were responsible for that. He comes to think of himself as a humble instrument in the hands of the Almighty. If you read his second inaugural address, he lays all this out. And then at the end of that address, of course, he those famous words where he answers basically people in the North who, by that time, that address came at the end of the war, and they wanted revenge against the South. They wanted to see the South on its knees. And instead, he says, we should act with malice toward none and charity for all. Charity meaning love for fellow man. So his faith is very, very evident in that magnificent second inaugural address.
What's something about Lincoln that you tried to emphasize that you saw lacking or underemphasized in depictions of him elsewhere?
Well, as I say, I try to focus on some of those, a lot of those small moments that I think make up a life in full. And so I think through those small moments, you get more of a sense of the personal tragedy of the Civil War. It wasn't just a national tragedy, it was a personal tragedy for a lot of people, including the Lincolns. It tore his family apart. Really tore his wife, Mary Lincoln, apart, especially after their son, Willie, dies in the White House. And I devote a couple of chapters to that where, you know, the reader goes through that. And she really begins to struggle after that. And so we see Lincoln struggling not only to prosecute this war and handle the presidency, but trying to help Mary through this time. I hope that scenes and glimpses like that really, as I say, bring some humanity to him.
And Linda, when we talk about Lincoln's life and times, there are no shortage of lessons that reverberate to our time and place.
Definitely. And we love the opportunity to bring authors in to help us connect with that. We often, every year, have a historical fiction novel, and it just really helps us see history in a completely more personal way when that person comes to life.
What do you hope people who read this novel now through Southern Lit Alliance and getting to see John speak, what do you hope people take away from that, Linda?
Well, we really believe that literature inspires, connects, and uplifts. And I think certainly reading about someone like Lincoln and what he overcame and the challenges and also what he accomplished definitely does that. Literature helps us gain empathy for other people as you step into Lincoln's eyes and how he made decisions and what he went through. You start to think about what would I have done if I'd been in that situation. And that's one of the beauties and benefits of literature. And that's what we try to bring to life when we bring any author.
And where can people go online for more information and to participate?
Yeah, so this is our part of our Southbound author lecture series. So they can go to southernlitalliance.org. On our front page will be a link to John Cribb, and it is free. We're doing all these virtual all this last year free, and they just need to register to get the Zoom link.
All right, Linda, John, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Christian J. Collier created the Plug Poetry Project to honor and grow the poetry community here in Chattanooga. On Saturday at 7 p.m., he will host a poetry virtual open mic on Facebook. Christian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us more about this open mic.
On February the 6th, We're going to be doing our first virtual open mic of 2021. We started, just like many other organizations did last year, doing virtual events, which has been really phenomenal, not just in allowing people the chance to share their work, but we're getting a lot of really quality work from a diverse palette of people. And if there was no pandemic and we were doing open mic events, we're really kind of relegated to people who are within the city or maybe a little bit beyond coming in. But since we're dealing in a virtual space, I know for the 6th, we're going to have people from at least 3 different time zones coming in and sharing work. So that's pretty phenomenal.
Everybody has been asked to bring 2 poems about love.
I like giving interesting prompts and challenges to people. And I thought that, especially being where we are now, where touch has simply become something that a lot of people don't have the capacity to do or encounter. What does it mean now when we think about love poems? So I'm asking people to really interrogate what that means for them. I'm of the mind that every poem is a kind of love poem, but the poems that I've been writing through the pandemic have been taking a surprising turn. So I wanted to kind of throw it out to people and see what they could come up with.
What are some of the surprising turns that you have found in your own poetry during the pandemic?
A lot of the work that I've been writing for maybe the past 2 years has kind of been interrogating what a ghost is. A ghost really is anything. There's a ghost of a person. There's a ghost of a touch. There's a ghost of a moment, right? All of us carry different ghosts with us at all times, and we bring them into different rooms. So when the pandemic first hit, I was coming off of a couple of losses in my family. So it's kind of the converging of how do we honor the people that we're writing about, but also how do we capture the moment and what exactly is going on within me. So the work has really kind of brought me into the equation a little bit more in a surprising way. A lot of the vulnerability, the pandemic has definitely been a character in the poems that I've been writing. I don't necessarily set out to write a particular poem like, oh, this is the poem that I'm going to write for the pandemic. I've been looking at text as being very malleable. So I'm just putting lines down and then I'm reconfiguring and then putting them together in ways that are interesting to me. And then, you know, at some point in time, I have a poem. And so that approach automatically brings me into surprise because I'm not directing what's happening. I'm just following the layers, putting it all together that way. So that's been surprising, but also at the end of it, seeing like, oh, this is totally about a meditation on the loss of Black life in the midst of the pandemic, or finding out that a friend has passed during the pandemic. But, you know, so all of these things are jumping in. But now it's definitely kept me on my toes and kept me engaged and, you know, seeing what else is there.
And beyond your own writing, beyond the open mic, what other plans for the Plug Poetry project in the coming weeks and months?
Before the pandemic, what I wanted to do, one of the things that I wanted to do with the Plug was to make it a resource for people. And that has not stopped because life does not stop and poetry does not stop. So there are constant opportunities for publishing contests. We have a number of writers who've reached out to me this year and they're like, all right, this is the year, Christian. This is the year I'm going to submit my first poem. I don't know what that looks like, but I want to do it. So we've been having an active dialogue about here are some things that you should probably try to do before submitting to a journal. And also like what the submission process looks like. I think a lot of times, you know, when we have these conversations, it's always encouraging, but it lacks that real life part of it too. So we've been having an active dialogue like, look, you're going to get rejected. You're going to get rejected a bunch. All of us do. Your favorite poet's going to still gets rejected to this day. That never stops. But here's what that means, and here's how you get used to it. So we're building up different muscles for people as far as that goes. Beyond that, we have a SoundCloud page that currently has one lengthy reading on it, and I'm hoping to do more with that. So that's another way to kind of reach out to the community to get more voices and more people involved. As you know, we talked about before, the docuseries, all of that is complete. That's done. That's out there and available for people. So the big thing now is just providing resources and content, different ways for people to get engaged and stay engaged. We have a wonderful community right now on Facebook. We have a little bit over 130 members. So just providing ways for them to engage and interact with each other and keep things sustained.
And where can people go online to keep up on everything with the Plug Poetry Project and find out more about this virtual open mic?
The best way is on Facebook. If you type in the search Plug Poetry Project, it'll come up. Join the group. Everybody's friendly. I make sure of that. I'm dad in there, so I'm making sure that everybody plays nice with each other. But yeah, that's kind of the hub for all things Plug right now. The event page is up right now. The list is full for the 6th, but people are welcome and encouraged to check it out. All of that's there. If you just want to say hello or you have any questions, you know, you can message me on there, or you can go to my website, which is christianjcollier.com. It also will lead you to the Facebook group, but you know, that's more of just all of the things that I'm a part of.
All right, Christian, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots talking writing. Our guest again this week is poet, naturalist, and essayist Ray Zimmerman. Last week we talked mostly about Ray's prose writing as a kind of portico to, I don't think you can really separate the two, right? Your poetry and your prose. Comes from the same.
Publishers tend to separate them.
but in terms of the impetus to write, yeah. Do you often sit down consciously to write a poem or to write an essay?
Quite often not. The one dividing point, I do some freelance journalism, and when I sit down to write that, I know it's going to be an article for a publication or a web page, because that's a completely different form of writing. I don't always know if a piece is going to be a poem or a short story.
Does it have anything to do with what you want to talk about?
No, it just has to do with what various rabbit holes my brain finds to go down.
Well, why don't we start with a poem? And would you care to talk about
the
inspiration for it?
Yeah. You know, Ron Rash, famous Southern author, once said in a talk that I attended that he didn't know when he started to write if the piece was going to be a poem, an essay, or a novel. I imagine he figured out pretty quickly if it was a novel.
You were thinking, wouldn't you?
Yeah, because he didn't stop writing, I guess. But, yeah, it's interesting that those genres, they don't... There is a little bit of flux between them because... And we have prose poems, which are just up against the line between prose and poetry, and right on the other side is the lyric essay. Mm-hmm. So it's not a fluid boundary, but there are works that go right up to the boundary.
Well, you know, as we were saying last week, I think your prose is informed by the fact that you think like a poet and write like one.
I suppose so. How about a performance poem? It's kind of been my signature piece for years. Sign. This message brought to you by the Tennessee Valley Authority, by business, industry, and government, by progress, prosperity, and jobs. Mercury. It's an element. It's a metal. It's a liquid. It's toxic. Mercury, it's a capsule launched into space to splash down in the Pacific Ocean. Alan Shepard rode the first Mercury capsule into space, splashed down in the pages of history books. Tennessee River waters contain mercury, not the space capsule, but the element. It's a metal, it's a liquid, it's toxic. Tennessee River fish contain mercury, not the space capsule, but the element. It's a metal. It's a liquid. It's toxic. Pregnant women should not eat these fish. Nursing mothers should not eat these fish. Children should not eat these fish. Adult males may eat these fish. Women past childbearing age may eat these fish. Elderly people are encouraged to eat these fish. Homeless people are required to eat these fish. That is all. Have a nice day.
Did you grow up in Tennessee?
No. Canton, Ohio. Which is interesting. It's just south of Canton, Ohio. And then later we moved into the southern part of the state, Wilmington, Ohio. But Canton, Ohio is a very industrial city, as Chattanooga was at one time. And I should say Canton was an industrial city. It's part of what's called the Rust Belt now. Mm-hmm. But everybody I knew, you know, their dad worked at U.S. Steel or Republic Steel or Timken Roller Bearing. You know, those are very industrial sounding company names. Well, they are industry. And then there was within a mile of our house, there was a small unreclaimed strip mine. And within 5 miles, there was an oil refinery. So it's outside of the part of Ohio that's considered Appalachian, but just barely, I would say. Southeastern Ohio is more like West Virginia and Kentucky than like, say, Indiana, Illinois, or the other lake states.
Less Midwestern.
Sort of Midwestern. I call that region the lake states. Southern Illinois has got a lot of coal mining also, so it's got some...
What were your feelings about that when you were growing up?
Well, you know, the coal mine, I didn't see coal mining taking place there. I was shocked when I saw one in operation, you know, this big shovel scraping the earth away and pulling out the coal. The unreclaimed strip mine that we lived near was interesting, though, because blackberries were intruding on the bare land, and so we went up there to pick blackberries, went there to look for snakes when we were kids, and... caught a few of them, which our mothers told us to take back when we got home. You know, it was kind of a fascinating place. The oil refinery was less appealing to me because, you know, you could tell you were getting close by the aroma, and there was a big fire on the top of the tower, the cracking tower, they're called, where effluents were being burned off.
Seems like it would be intimidating to kids, that kind of thing.
My father once called it the Statue of Liberty because of the flame. when we started calling it that, he said, "That's not good. Don't call it that. That's disrespectful to the statue." But
how did you become a naturalist? Was that in reaction to having grown up surrounded by industry?
Well, there was also open space. There was woods behind us and a wheat field across from us. Not a wheat field, a hay field that they baled the hay. There was a working farm across from us. So that was an influence. My father hunted regularly, so we ate game for dinner. We went fishing. He taught me to fish. We did some camping. So that probably was an influence. And then there's the reaction to the industrial and extractive industry around us. I later learned that a couple of my cousins were made really sick because they lived closer to the oil refinery than we did. And I think their families actually moved elsewhere to preserve their health.
Have you written much about that period of your life?
Not much.
When did you start writing?
Started writing, well, I've kept a journal most of my life, and I've written some journalistic pieces to try to publish in magazines, newspapers most of my life. Didn't really start poetry until around 1990. So, you know, it was a good 40 years without doing
it. What drew you to it?
Hearing it, meeting other people that wrote poetry. See, I don't think I ever met anyone that was a poet before I moved here to Chattanooga.
When was that?
That was 1990. I came originally to work at what was then called the Chattanooga Nature Center. It's now been absorbed into reflection writing. And I was still really focused on journalism, freelance journalism for my writing. But I began to meet poets and essayists and started doing more of that kind of writing and occasional fiction. I think I did write some fiction when I was much younger. It was horrible stuff, though. I've not written any.
Well, share with us another of your poems.
I would consider to be of any account till recently. Cranes. Their voices call to my ears, pull my eyes skyward. Heard before sighted, sandhills from Michigan. Cranes overhead, wings southward, call my thoughts to fly with them to Okefenokee or the Gulf Coast of Florida. The cranes arrive, bring their news of winter, their voices compared to barking geese, to the bugling of wild elks. These are no geese, their words no honk, no barnyard bark for them. It is a rattling coo, doves amplified 1,000 times. Arrows shot from a bow, they neither swoop nor slow. They rocket southward, abandon me here, rooted to the ground.
Ray Zimmerman is our guest. So you start out as a journalist, and that's a format all of its own, isn't it? You can't get away with too much poetic expression in journalism.
No. I wouldn't say I was a journalist per se. I did freelance journalism.
What did you tend to write about?
About nature, natural areas. I think the first published piece I had was about the Wild Horses of Assateague Island. It was called Annual Assateague Pony Roundup, published in a little tabloid-type paper out of Topeka, Kansas, called Cappers. Cappers, they've since been absorbed by another similar paper called The Grit. It's just kind of some people would say a throwaway, but I hate to say that about any writing.
It strikes me, though, that you have in common with journalists that you always tend to write with a point.
Okay. Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah. That's true. The thing I don't have in common with journalists is an ability to meet deadlines. You've got to admire those guys. They're ladies too. They turn around a story and it's ready for publication in time for the next paper. That's a skill I don't have.
I think it's to some degree there's a formula to it, as I guess there is to anything that you have to turn around that quickly.
Yeah,
you know, and that I think is. In common with poetry, perhaps, you know, it's a real discipline. You have to start thinking like that and organize your thoughts that way.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Whereas for you, you're perhaps more an essayist, right? You like to be more reflective than that.
I like to be reflective. The sonnet that I read for last week, that follows a very ironclad formula.
Mm-hmm.
Originated, that was a Petrarchan sonnet. Shakespeare modified it and came up with a new formula, but it's still a formula. in the villain.
Or format, anyway.
It's a format, yeah. And the villanelle, the pantoum, the rhyming couplet, which I've done. I've done some rhyming couplets. Those are fun. I don't like to do a lot of them because I start to I think I start to sound like Dr. Seuss. And, but there's form poems are fun. They aren't real popular anymore other than haiku. And most haiku written in English aren't really haiku, but we don't want to go into why that's the case. But that's the only form poem that I know that's, you know, that's probably the most popular form worldwide. And I'm not sure why, except that it's short. And it looks easy until you try to do it.
Yeah, what was that? Annie Dillard said she, at one point, she wrote a series of poems taking lines from books.
And Mornings she said, Like This was the name of the book.
She said, it looks easy, but it was incredibly hard.
Found she said, poems.
It should be the other way around. It should look hard, but be easy.
It's hard to fit those together to where you actually mean something. She did a good job, great job with that. I think that was one of only two books of poetry that she published, as far as I know. Her very first book was a book of poems, Tickets to a Prayer Wheel. But I think once she published her second book, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, and it got a Pulitzer Prize, her future was kind of set in concrete.
Where do you go from there, right?
Yeah, she definitely established herself as a prose author. And very good ones.
So you like haiku, you enjoy reading it?
I write a few. But
writing it?
Yeah.
Talk about something that looks easy but is hard. That in some ways is the definitive. It looks on the page so simple.
Mm-hmm.
But in that simplicity is such an enormous challenge.
And the rules are multitude. I need to reread the book by Stephen Addis where he's talks about there's got to be a word identifying the season, which could be frog if it's a springtime poem. Could be snow if it's a winter poem. Wild geese, I think, for fall, maybe spring, I'm not sure. Azaleas for spring. And you should only use each of those words so many times in your writing. I guess you give up after you've exhausted all those possibilities.
So at one and the same time, it's literal and metaphoric, just to add to the challenge.
Yeah.
On Scenic Roots, this is Talking Writing. Our guest is poet, naturalist, and essayist, Ray Zimmerman. We'll be right back.
If we have time, I'd like to do one short poem.
Please do.
You ask about from my childhood era. This one is one of my most requested poems. It's called Christmas Papers. I was older when I noticed the same color and pattern on the Christmas paper. Each year, a pattern graced a smaller package. Christmas morning emanated excitement and opening packages with scissors, carefully cutting tape as so as not to rip the paper. I was older when I noticed my mother's hands ironing on Christmas night. She ironed the same towel again and again. Under the towel, Christmas papers lost their creases, regained smooth surfaces. Her hands rolled the paper we could never replace. Choosing between gifts and new paper, she chose gifts. And I guess that gets requests because every time I read it, almost invariably, someone would say, will say, I remember my grandmother doing that. or there will occasionally be someone in the audience that says, I still do that. There are still people out there who save the Christmas paper and reuse it next year. That's got to be it. Testament to thriftiness. And I'm all in favor of thriftiness.
You are, huh?
Yes. Our society seems to produce so much disposable stuff. It's just crapola, most of it. Pardon me, I don't know if I can say that word on the radio or not, but most of it is unnecessary.
Well, it certainly runs completely against your philosophy as I would assume, as a naturalist, as somebody who cares about the natural world.
Yeah, I try to buy all my clothes in thrift stores because so much of it gets thrown away or disposed. You know, thrift stores, I've heard, get so much donated that they actually give them to other charitable organizations who bail them up and send them overseas, often back to the countries where they were made, but the people who live there can't afford to buy them. So it's called a circular economy.
And somebody was saying that the demand in those often third world countries is apparently declining. They're not as interested as they were at one time in used American clothing.
Yeah, well, maybe they can afford to buy new stuff now.
Maybe they want to wear clothes that reflect their own culture more rather than something that says New York Yankees or something.
You know? Yeah, that's probably a good point. Mm. Probably a good point.
What do you do as a vice president of the Chattanooga Writers Guild? What are your responsibilities under that title?
That's an interesting job because it has no defined job responsibility other than to take the president's place if needed. I, though, edit the newsletter.
How often do you publish it?
It's semi-monthly, twice a month. So I think, you know, that I like that because it's sort of like journalism. It's more like journalism than like creative writing.
Mm.
And it keeps the members informed. It has a pretty high open rate compared to, at least so the online service we use to distribute it says, that the open rate and click rate is good, which should make sense because the people actually sign up to receive.
Well, you were talking last week about, you know, the necessity to be working online and how that's in some ways proved to be a real boon for you.
Yeah.
You're meeting writers from, and that kind of, it makes me wonder whether the Guild is going to respond to that potential expansion that the net offers you, that you'll invite people to become members of the Guild who don't necessarily live in Chattanooga.
Yeah, well, we've always had a few outliers who join because they want to participate in our contest, possibly be published in our annual anthology. I would say that if the Guild is going to survive, they're going to have to capitalize on that and start pulling more people in to their events. There's diminishing returns, I suppose, at some point because, you know, you can only fit so many readers into an open mic online. I know there's one local one, not by the Guild. Oh, I think Christian Collier does one. And I think he limits it to just 16 participants, which is a good number. The one out of Nashville that I participate in cuts off sign-in at 25 people, but they give out the link and more show up. And they just add them in. So 4 minutes to a person, possibly 30, 35 people reading in one night. That's more than 2 hours. Yeah. And I watched one out of the UK. It's from Scotland. A Scot was the MC, and he announced an intermission an hour and 45 minutes in. And I didn't come back after the intermission.
Satiated your appetite.
He went, at least 3.5 hours. That's I get Zoom fatigue after that.
But there's also, of course, so many people make podcasts now.
Yeah. And a lot of people do that informally where they use the go live option on Instagram or Facebook. I've done some of that. I don't announce them in advance, though. I like to just start and see who shows up.
It seems to me that the beauty of it is, although you may not be in any given time speaking to a lot of people, you can go on as often as you care to. And each time you're more than likely going to reach people you didn't reach the previous time. Whereas when it's contained locally, I think probably tends to be the same people in the audience a lot.
Yeah, it depends on how broad your base of acquaintances in the online platform is.
And the reputation that you develop.
Yeah. The other thing is that it does preserve it. So you can repost it in groups or pages and so forth, up to the point where, you know, you don't fatigue the audience and they say, oh, it's him again. you don't want to quite get to that point.
I don't think you need to be concerned about that based on our conversation and what you've read so far. We have enough time for you to share one more if you care to.
Okay, let me... Reincarnation. An old black vulture landed in a tree overlooking South Chickamauga Creek, gave me a sidelong glance. I thought of Edward Abbey, critic of government agencies, professor and park ranger. Abbey is buried in an illegal grave. A cairn of stones covers his remains. His friends saw to his request, wrote on one stone, Edward Abbey, no comment. The nemesis of Glen Canyon Dam desired no memorial, got one anyway. He always said he'd come back as a vulture next time, just seemed fitting. I looked up into the oak, said, hey there, Ed, looks like a good day for flying. Abby didn't say a word, just gave me that sidelong glance, the old buzzard.
Thank you, Ray. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
You're always welcome.
I enjoyed reading.
Our guest, poet, naturalist, and essayist Ray Zimmerman's most recent writing and photography is collected on his website, rayzimmermanauthor.com. On Scenic Roots, this is Talking Writing on listener-supported public radio.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.